Right, hello, hello everyone. Basically speaking, I'm not going to do a DSTL sales pitch. You'll be glad to hear. That's not what you're here for. I am going to sail through some of the initial slides because I know it's stuff you guys already do, but I will sort of allow you to have a brief look at them because you never know, you might find some of it useful. For those who are not aware, naturally, as you can imagine, to support all of these nice guys, we do an awful lot of wargaming, an awful lot of testing, an awful lot of enablement for testing, and that's what I'm going to be telling you about today. So basically, I'm going to have a brief comment about some of the considerations. That's the bit I'm going to sail through. I'm going to have a brief word about why use a manual wargame at all. So only a brief word, because again, most of you guys are the converted, so I expect hallelujahs as probably for that one. And then basically, I'm going to talk about more the sort of levels of wargaming and the types of wargaming that we operate at. To give you an idea, we tend to do pretty well almost everything. I want to give you some examples of that, to give you a little bit to familiarise with, and also things you can ask questions about when we're having the broader discussion. So basically, we use these things mostly on the broad scheme to have a look at what might happen in a particular situation. We want to look at new technologies, we want to look at new threats, what the bad guys are actually going to do. We want to find out what the challenges are. Are they technical? Are they social? Are they military? Are they economic? This is not just a purely sort of land-based army approach. And obviously, we want to test some of these things and see if they work in a wargaming context. And particularly for structures, because obviously, as they adapt, we have to adapt too. We have to introduce the technologies, the doctrine, and the training methods to go with it to make the military function, hopefully, effectively in the challenges it will face in the future. So, this is the obvious sell-by slide here. Basically, you know, the first question we always have to ask is this the most appropriate, the most useful, the most effective way to study the subject? And then basically once we've done that, we go through a whole complex process of finding out then the optimum way to approach the war game itself. And you can probably imagine this is a whole load of discussions with all the specialists in the countries in question, because invariably we set it in an illustrative location so we can actually test it coherently and include some of the wackier challenges that only real life throws at you, like weather, dust, disease and social interaction, which is usually the most powerful. And then we have to decide whether we're going to do this purely as a sort of DSTL level technical analysis, or whether we're going to call in the military. Now, we have our own military advisors, and they're incredibly useful and very effective guys, but quite often we like to bring in an entire headquarters, because of course what you do there is you get the advantage of having the whole planning process laid out. It's good for them, it's good for us, and it means we cover the whole story. We also have to decide how much bad we're going to allow the bad guys to be. Some cases you want to just test them to give a rough idea. You don't actually often want someone to play to win. You want someone to play the bad guys and how they will win. And this is one of the differences between your conventional war game. It's more of a role-playing game than it is a sort of, you know, sit there and make the maximum maneuvers to achieve. You, as Red, need to win as the guys you're playing as. So if you do something which only, let's say, the Americans would do, and you're playing some very quiet, distant, primitive country in another part of the world where you don't often get high technology, then clearly it's not going to be relevant to our guys as a war game. They want to know what happens if they face someone who has that sort of character. And obviously how it's recorded is very important. Obviously, central to this, we're always utterly focused on the question, the person, the information that people want to explore, and we want to explore as many options about this as possible. So we want to design a game that can be repeated, that we can test different alternative outcomes, different mechanisms, different force structures, and we want to do this cheaply and effectively in such a way that we get the sort of results we can use to analyse at another level. Obviously, and this is a really dull slide I apologise for, we are also trying to ensure that the scope of this war game, it doesn't wander off that scope, that there are clear boundaries, everyone knows exactly what they're testing. And if there are branch points, we identify those and we test them with another game. What we don't do is burden that game or disrupt that game or misdirect that game and lose time, and particularly when you've got a headquarters present, all of that effort looking at something which isn't directly concerned with the requirement in the first place. Brief moment about why use manual war games. They are incredibly flexible. No matter how good a computer programmer you are, you will not be able to put in the sort of stuff that I can throw into a manual war game. I can create a table off the cuff. I can change a rule on the day. Someone will ask a question and go, this is a key issue, we want to explore this. Right, let's do that now. And RCAT, for example, is a very good example, is very good at adding layers of modules. As long as you record when and why and what the purpose is, it's very, very adaptable, and it can do things that you cannot otherwise do. It can also be designed in a way the computer is very bad at, and actually mirroring what planning does on the day, even down to the presentation. And I'll give an example of that as we're going along. It also facilitates insights, which is nice. So obviously we've got lots of stuff to do, lots of stuff to blow up, lots of people to be able to talk to, and lots of insights to record. So basically let me give you a few examples of that sort of stuff. Strategic level games. Now these are the ones that when we were talking about Paul Mill, and I chuckled away when somebody said this, who's heard of Paul Mill. Naturally, of course, if you don't do this, you miss the point. This is the level you need to be able to start at in terms of exploring the key issues in the campaign, the political issues, getting the other government departments involved, getting things so that allies, for example, can work together. We do games with the French, we do games with the Americans, so we can understand how integration and how force alignment works with our allies. We also do games in context, in country. The top picture there is General Karimi, who is the four-star who is chief of staff of the Afghan army, talking to General Scaparati, who in later 2011 was in charge of ISAF in Kabul. So basically speaking, these guys are witnessing a war game which is designed to explore the dynamics and issues that will happen in the context of Afghanistan in that period. And they want to look at the next 6 months and what will occur. And they have UN players, they have NGO players, they have Foreign Office players, they have governance specialists, and all of this being facilitated by a war game that has a series of modules around it facilitated by DSDL. And a lot of that is manual, and it has to be, because of course these guys throw in some wacky questions and make it difficult. Operational level war games, you will not be surprised to hear, are our bread and butter, and Paul will tell you a lot more about how we process these and understand these later. But basically we do an awful lot of this. This is your classic Kerr war game. Awful lot of this stuff goes on. All the military factors have to be obviously put into there, but we try and introduce other layers of interest to make the game more interesting. I would love to tell you some of the scenarios we look at, but I suspect I'll be dragged off the stage and beaten to death. But suffice to say, there are very few parts of the world that we do not examine in some context at some stage, because we want to understand how our troops will operate in a wide array of countries against an even wider array of potential opponents. Tactical level games, another one that's particularly effective with manual gaming. Yes, you can run about shooting people on Call of Duty, but you're much better off doing a manual game when you want to put in something, again, which is human. So for testing rules of engagement, in a computer game, it's very difficult to put the small child with the AK-47 in at the moment you want them to go in. At least very few computer games enable us to do that. But if you want to test that in a tactical context, there's a situation, there's a challenge, the kid steps out, what do you do? Well, you don't want to kill the child in a certain circumstance, most circumstances, because even if he's a threat, you do not want to take down someone like that. Rules of engagement, the British Army don't like doing that. But you want to put that in because it's a challenge, it's an issue, it's something they've got to overcome, and in a tactical context, it adds complication. But a computer can't do that. And particularly when you're dealing with the almost role-playing level, when you're talking about wargaming for SF, when you talk about individual decision-making in a very personal context, then computers at the moment are completely unable to touch this for us, and we do an awful lot of that sort of stuff. So seminar gaming, you've already had a briefing this morning, so I'm not going to tell you an awful lot about that. It'd be great if I got those two involved. I just included that purely because it was a nice briefing. General Cowan is the commander of 3rd Div, so he'll be running the Armed Resolve game for us as the overarching main dude there. But as you can probably imagine, we do a lot of this, and a lot of the seminar games we do are in preparation for larger war games, because you can explore the implications, you can explore the consequences, you can explore the risks, you can have a look at some of the COA options without calling in the headquarters and spending all the money. So we use seminar wargaming a lot to sort of look at the parameters of things. Thematic war games are one that we haven't discussed at all so far in the conference, but what these are is when you take a particular issue that you want to explore. And the two I'm going to use an example are IEDs and casualty evacuation. So you're not looking at an entire war game with an entire village or entire, you know, taking a location or seizing what you want. This is about what are the differences in getting a casualty out in this context against another. So if casualty evacuation, let's say in Afghanistan, follows a particular process and procedure, and after 10 years, you can probably imagine, we get this really right. We're very, very good at this. Us and the Americans have a very cooperative process, which I won't go into details, but basically we shoulder each other's burdens and we help out. And the combined medical assets of UK, US and Afghanistan are phenomenal. But if you're facing a different opponent who is not so happy about air power, who is equally ruthless or better equipped, then you have to change the way you operate. So naturally, you have to go through that, and you have to explore those parameters, test it out, and have your medical guys go, damn, we're not going to get to the guy in an hour because this, this, and this. So how do we get the casualty out facing that opponent? And of course, the ID one, you could imagine the amount of work we do on trying to find ways to counter new IED technologies, to explore ways to confuse the enemy so they don't realize we've actually countered them, and looking at the ways in which they might counter stuff cheaply. We've introduced stuff in the past, for example, worth hundreds of thousands, and the Taliban countered it with about 20p after about 48 hours. Now, that's really depressing, but if you red team it, you war game it, you go to the war gamers, what do? Well, we'll do this. We've just wasted the money. And therefore, it's a very useful insight, and you can only get that out of putting the context to people and letting them talk their way through it, war gaming. We also do experiential war games. Now, this very nicely fits in with the business war games you guys were discussing earlier, which I'm sorry I missed that one. But basically what you do is you put a context to a group of other government departments and their key individuals, key personnel, and you basically put them through the story, put them through the narrative. It's very similar to a war game context, but the difference is you throw in the kind of issues that the military aren't necessarily that excited by, such as very close-in media information operations creation. So what you do is, you've got a terrorist bomb, it explodes, King's gets completely devastated, there are students all over the place dead. Unfortunately, it's hit international relations. You could lose the war status people, but the international relations are much more valuable, they tend to be prettier. So naturally, all the emergency services come pouring in to rescue these people. Well, obviously, you're putting out media, and everyone's putting out media. The problem is what happens if it's incoherent? The way we did, a game involving one of these situations, and we had a media cell whose job it was to take the government announcements and misinterpret them. So someone was playing The Guardian, The Daily Mail, The Daily Telegraph, and these people took the government announcements, laughed their heads off, and then they had enormous fun misinterpreting. They then had a public cell, and the public cell was told the government announcements, then they were told the media's opinion. Then we asked them, through a series of surveys during the evolving situation, what they thought. Very, very useful, because people tend not to consider what the general public thinks. They think, this is my beautiful idea, I'm going to put this narrative out, and it'll be believed. Well, the trouble is, the other bugger down the office has also put an idea, which also he thinks will be believed, and the two of them don't necessarily align. So very, very useful, very good way of improving situational analysis and the way in which people evolve their message. And you can probably imagine, if you note all those present, we've also done a little work with our good friends over the pond, which I won't discuss here, but they share this same sort of interest, is putting people into the experience, whatever it is, and then wargaming it. It's very, very similar to what the business wargamers, I suspect, have been discussing with you. We also have a look at the far future. Particularly looking about 20 years out. It's based on the global strategic trends concept. And what we're trying to do here is create scenarios and creating war games. To do that, we've got to create the future. So we explore the trends and shocks. We develop the war games themselves, push them into a future setting. We try and make people think about how the world will be. We'll be wrong, but it's better than not looking at it at all. And it does mean that it has people coming away from thinking, well, yeah, the implications of that technology will be this, and therefore will affect the way we operate. And the theory is eventually we'll do a series of war games genuinely set in a much more plausible future environment, a set of future environments, which hopefully challenge them to think about genuine force development that far out, which is quite difficult. And I use those pictures because it gives you a rough idea of the kind of difference 20 years can make, particularly the Aral Sea here, in terms of how the world can change. It's a particularly stunning image, that one. Obviously, we do a lot of actual support of UK planning. We go out there and do stuff. A little Libyan tank there getting plinked by the RAF. And these are a wide array of types of war games, similar to the ones I've discussed earlier. And these enable commanders in the field or about to deploy to test their plans, to think about issues, test them out with their forces, and also see how their planners face a problem. It's quite useful to war game something as opposed to exercise it. There's no judgment, there's no punishment, but it gives an opportunity for these guys to go out there and plan, and their commander to spot the good guys, the gun and the good girls, who will do the sort of stuff they want to do on the day. One example of this is RCAT doing the exercise on resolve. This one is done by 3DIV. This will be done, I think, next month. And this one, we're going to put them through a scenario, and this is a full-blown headquarters approach. So this is going to be dozens and dozens of people going through every stage of the planning process facilitated by the war game. And if you had a chance to have a look or play RCAT, it'll have given you a very good impression of the baseline. All the modules will add to that, we can't discuss, but certainly RCAT is a phenomenally good framework in which to base your ideas. This is a classic one, you've heard several people talk about it already, so I'm not going to bore you about it, but what I will do is put up that review by General David Rodriguez, who's now AfricaCom for the US, but certainly he found the war game extremely useful for exploring the parameters of what was going on in Afghanistan in early 2011. And it's just the sort of impact that, you know, as someone who's a practitioner, is enormously satisfying to receive from someone who's obviously dealing with genuine challenges in the field. So in summary and conclusion, if you've got a problem, this is the classic A-team quote, but corrupted, then obviously designing a war game is a very good way to be able to look at an issue, explore the situation, and hopefully get a solution. And there are many, many ways, and as Graham pointed out, many complementary ways in which you can do this. I think questions at the end. Thank you very much. Okay.